UFP, the United Federation of Podcasts.
Welcome to Franchise Fatigue, the little podcast on the United Federation of Podcast Network, where your hosts go through movies, remakes, and sequels. I'm your host, Brandon Shea Mutella, and joining me, as always, is my ever-constant co-host, Zach Moore. Zach, witness! Witness me!
Mediocre!
Aww. I thought it was a pretty good intro. How you doing, buddy?
Good, Brandon. And hey, we have a baby brother, perfect in every way, Mr. Ryan Unicomb with us here today. What's up, Ryan?
Good night, guys. Thanks for having me.
Hey, buddy. Nice to meet you. Welcome to the show. Welcome to Franchise Fatigue. I hear that you like Mad Max.
I do. I love Mad Max. I absolutely love Mad Max.
Is it a requirement that you love Mad Max? Because you're also, if you can't tell, listeners, Ryan is Australian.
Yeah. it's part of our getting your passports and being able to have access to Medicaid. You've got to prove that you've got that you're in love with the Mad Max franchise. Mm-hmm.
So what's the question to prove? Do they say who runs Bartertown? Is that the question that they ask?
No, we pretty much just get the silver spray can and witness me and they sign off on it and away we go.
Awesome, excellent. So yeah, today we are discussing Mad Max Fury Road, the fourth and latest entry. We might be getting a couple more, apparently. I'm looking forward to that, looking forward to checking that out. But this is crazy because this came out, what was it, 21 years later? 21 years after Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome, we got a whole new movie. This had been a movie that, I think as I mentioned in a previous episode, I had been seeing in movie magazines for like, since the mid-90s as something that was coming. I made the joke that I saw it right next to the article saying that we were getting the Arnold Schwarzenegger Planet of the Apes movie.
Right.
Right? So yeah, like
Jim Cameron's Spider-Man, these were all
Jim
coming.
Jim Cameron's Spider-Man, these were all the things that were coming. These were one of those films that was always rumored to be on the back burner. And so when this thing came out, it's like, holy smokes, this is finally coming out. And then not only that, but not only was it good, but it was critically acclaimed, and if I remember correctly, this freaking thing was nominated for Best Picture, wasn't it?
It was. It was nominated for Best Picture. It was actually, well, we'll get into trivia in a second, because I kind of want to go around the table about our experiences with this film before we get into it, but this is the first time the fourth film of a franchise was nominated for Best Picture, which I was surprised by, Brandon, because I had thought Children of the Corn 4 was nominated for Best Picture, for how often we talk about it.
It wasn't. I'm really sad to say it wasn't, so... Unfortunately, that honor went to Children of the Corn 5.
Yeah, oh, that's right. So that's the distinction there. But yeah. Hey, what's interesting about it being honored for Best Picture as well is that this is only the second sequel to receive a Best Picture nomination when none of its predecessors had been nominated. Can y'all guess what the other one is?
I know.
Okay.
I'll leave Ryan, it to our guest to see if he knows, but I know.
Sorry, what was it? It's
the second sequel to be nominated for Best Picture when none of the other films of the franchise before it were nominated for Best Picture.
Interesting. I want to say Dark Knight, but I know that it didn't get nominated for Best Picture, and that's why they had to change.
That's why they changed the Oscars. Yeah. Because of the Reader getting nominated over the Dark Knight.
So. I don't know, actually. I actually don't know that, no.
Return
Toy
of the King.
Toy Story 3.
Really?
Brandon is over here acting like he knows.
Toy Story 3. Toy what about Return 3. Of the King? Were the first two nominated?
The Two Towers was nominated.
Two Towers.
Was it? Oh, okay. Yeah. I didn't know that. Okay. Well, then the Two Towers would have been the first one.
Right.
So that would be the third and fourth time then, because we had Two Towers and Return of the King.
No, no, no. This is the first time that a sequel have been nominated without any of its other...
Oh, without any. Okay, okay. So because 2 and 3 were nominated. Okay, I get
you. Yeah. You know what I mean? Okay. Like, it's the... Okay. You guys understand at home. Yeah.
It's 6 o'clock in the morning here. Okay, I'm freaking tired.
We're off to a strong start. We're in three different time zones. It's okay. So anyway, interesting stuff. But yeah, for me, I saw this at the theater, and I think I had. It was one of these movies where, like, I wasn't like Mad Max is not like the top of my like must see fandoms of all time. I was definitely going to see it, right? And then I think it had been like a week or two, and the hype was so high on this. And whenever that happens, I become suspicious, right? I'm like, all right, you know, well, people just riding the wave of what people are saying, right? And no, it totally holds up. Like, I was like, this holds up to the hype and was an amazing film. And I was very happy that it did, because so often you wait and you go a couple weeks later and you're like, okay, well, I mean, that was fine. I don't know what people are that excited about, but this was clearly an event. And, I was happy to say it lived up to the hype and kind of like got me reinterested in the Mad Max movies, which as we talked about here, I'd seen on cable and stuff as a kid and stuff, but was never like, oh, well, let me recheck these out. But these kind of reinvigorated that for me. And everybody was really excited for a sequel, because you know, Tom Hardy signed on to 3, and they were going to do a spinoff with Charlize Theron, and it was Mad Max was going to come. It was going to be the new franchise, and then we're still waiting for another. For another movie. That's where we are today. But anyway, what about you, Ryan? What was your experience with this film?
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess my perspective is a bit different, being that I am from Australia, from the country where they filmed all of them except for this latest one. But basically, yeah, it's something that we sort of like grew up around, and it was always like really ingrained into our culture that this was kind of like out there as representative of like this is what kind of Australian culture. Or this is how we're going to represent Australian culture and media.
So Australia is a post-apocalyptic wasteland.
Exactly.
Oh, interesting.
Right. Exactly.
Interesting.
Right. And we love our little souped-up cars and all this stuff.
Your eccentric wardrobe, yeah.
Throwing spears and yeah, like I grew, and it's just ingrained into our culture here in the same way that like Babe and stuff is as well. Like because they were, you know, massive things to come out of our industry, which is relatively small. For Fury Road in particular, it's sort of been this weird thing because it was always in our news cycle over here, and being that I am in the film industry, I'd heard a lot of like behind the scenes stuff, and you know, they wanted to film originally out in like Broken Hill and Singleton and Silverton and stuff, where they filmed most of the original trilogy, and then we had like unprecedented rains come through, and like the desert area that they wanted to film parts in was suddenly covered in greenery and all kinds of stuff. And then tax things got involved, and all of a sudden they were filming wherever they ended up filming. And so it was kind of like everyone expected it to be this great calamity of like, you know, Warner Brothers had invested this insane amount of money, and, you know, the filmmakers hadn't been especially active for quite a bit of time. And then it comes out to this, you know, everyone loves it, greatest action movie of all time. It's you know, it is getting spin-offs. They're prepping to shoot Furiosa, or they were prepping to shoot Furiosa until the lockdowns in New South Wales and stuff like that. But it'll be interesting to see where it goes from here, because it has the potential to be massive.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that the studio is really invested in it. So, but I think it's a bit of a race against the clock, because some of the key filmmakers involved are quite old at this point in time. So get on it. Mm-hmm. And quick.
I don't know, man. George Miller, he could pull a Ridley Scott and just direct until he's like 90. These guys just still working today. But where we stand now is this is the most recent and latest Mad Max mm-hmm. film. Although it's been, gosh, 7 years?
Yeah.
Feels like this just came out, right? That's how it works, right? And yeah. You're talking about the Furiosa film. They had said, and I guess this is a little bit trivia, but we can kind of say this now and really dive into this film.
What did you want to hear my experience with this film, Zach?
No, Brandon, we're done with that.
Oh, okay.
I was just simply it's called segueing in podcasts. You know, he said something, I was going to follow up and do a little, okay, but please, okay. let's just interrupt the flow of the conversation. Let's talk about what you want to talk about.
Okay. I saw the movie in the theaters once and I really loved it, and I didn't get around to it until we watched it again for this movie, and then I watched it twice. I watched it in regular, and then I watched it in 3D because I have a 3D projector. So
beautiful.
Did you watch the Chrome and Steel edition, Brandon?
No, my version doesn't have that. I know that Mike Schindler's a big fan of that, but I'm not really a big fan of these movies like going into black and white. Like I have Frank Darabont's The Mist, and there's a bonus disc that has that in black and white, and I watched it. I'm like, I don't think it really improves it. And then Criterion released Parasite on Blu-ray, and the second disc is in black and white. And I think that actually detracts from the film, because color is such an important part of that film. You know, like, there's a sequence, like, this doesn't spoil the movie, where they pour some hot sauce on a white napkin, some red hot sauce on a white napkin, and it's like, it's kind of a major moment in the film, and to see that in black and white, like, it to not see that vibrant red on the napkin, I think detracts from it, you know. So I don't know, like, I don't understand this wave. Like, if you want to film it in black and white, that's fine, but there's a lot of movies that are designed for color and should be in color.
It's kind of like Superman coming back from the dead in a black costume, but in the black and white version of Justice League, you think he's just wearing his normal costume.
Yeah.
That's now, funny. I will say, you know, I do respect it when they recolor time and the contrast and that kind of thing. They don't just turn off the color. But it is an odd trend. I mean, the Logan, right, is another one of these, the last Wolverine film. So
that's actually it's my preferred version of that movie, actually.
Really? Why is that for you, Ryan? Just curious.
It's just like it's so much more about the performance for me in that regard. Obviously, you know, there's spectacle that movie and whatever, blah, blah, blah. But, like, what Jim Mangold did in collaboration with Hugh Jackman and particular Patrick Stewart, in that movie, like, from a performance standpoint, is astounding for those characters. And, like, for me, like, obviously I would watch the color version. I've got like, two or three copies of the 4K one, the Blu-ray one, Steelbook. But for me, yeah, Logan Noir, the black and white monochromatic version, is the sort of definitive version for me, because it's just, I don't know, just for me in particular, it helps me lock in on from a performance standpoint. I don't know why, it's just, you know, less distractions. Maybe it's the ADD or something.
Interesting.
You know, me joking about this being watched by you, Brandon, in black and white, I actually have not seen the Chrome and Steel edition, so I could not comment on that. But Ryan, do you feel like there's a similar thing here? Does it help you lock in, or does it kind of a wash for you, just a different way to watch it? And
well, I mean, it's so different, because, like, what Tom Hardy's doing is so subtle in comparison to what, like, Hugh Jackman's doing or Daphne Keane's doing and stuff like that. So different sort of thing. But I mean, Charlize Theron, though, obviously, you know, gives a hell of a performance in Fury Road. I think there is definitely merits to the black and chrome edition, but it wouldn't be my preferred way to watch it.
Well, I mean, sure. I'd be interested to find out where I could get a copy of the black and chrome 3D edition. You know, so
I don't know whether did they ever release.
Probably not.
Yeah, because even for us here, it was like packaged as like a very special limited thing that was like by the Steelbook, and it was just like another like sealed thing on the front of the plastic, like it was
just
literally an attached afterthought, just a disc. Yeah, which speaks volumes for media distribution in Australia and Oceania as a whole.
Apparently I'm the only person on the planet who actually loves 3D and Children of the Corn, so
I love 3D.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, buddy,
you speak my language.
I had forgotten there were some clear like 3D moments of this film where someone just flies at the camera like, oh, this wasn't 3D. We get it.
But like when that steering wheel or whatever right at the end like flies.
I think one of the most blatant theme park-esque 3D I've seen recently is Beowulf. You guys know what I'm talking about? Did you ever see the Robert Zemeckis Beowulf? Yeah, like it's like, you know, somebody rides up like on a horse with a spear like pointed at the camera. I'm like, come on, man, what is this, a theme park ride? But it's like in the 50s and the 80s, I was like, okay, but like we are more sophisticated now. We don't need this. Exactly. We spilled some water on you or something, right? So anyway, just 3D is fun, Zach, stuff.
3D is an art that you are just not fine-tuned enough to appreciate. That's all I'm going to say.
3D black and white is so much these days, right? I just want to watch
Creature
a movie.
Creature from the Black Lagoon and Revenge of the Creature Man, 3D black and white.
But from the 50s. So it's like a fun artifact of time, much like Jaws 3D.
They're ahead of their time.
Head of their time indeed. But yeah, this is the most recent, latest Mad Max film. there was talk at the time, like, oh yeah, Tom Hardy signed on to do more, Into the Wasteland was a title that was thrown around, and there was going to be a Furiosa prequel, but there has been a lot of a holdup for these for various reasons, one of which being George Miller and Warner Brothers had a dispute about unpaid finances, so that held things up for a while, but it seems like things have been settled, and they're what is it, Warner Brothers and directors, man, if you're involved in Justice League and you do stuff in black and white and you work for Warner Brothers, there's gonna be drama, apparently.
A storied history.
All George Miller needs to do to get this cleared up is to start production on Contact 2.
That's right. Here, we're gonna pay you to just go away.
We'll give you the
rights. Such a strange bit of trivia for George Miller. Do you know anything about that, Ryan? George Miller directing Contact?
I think I actually did read something about this a long time. Very recently, I only rewatched Contact again for the first time in years. But I did read something forever ago, but no, refresh me. Refresh my memory.
So apparently Warner Brothers wanted him to drop out of directing Contact so badly, they gave him all the rights to Mad Max 2 and Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome. Like, here, take complete control of these movies you directed for us. Just drop out of directing Contact. And I'm like, wow, I guess they either Robert Zemeckis was really like, hey, I really want to do this, make it work for me, or they were like, it's not working out, George Miller, go away. But such a bizarre thing. But George Miller has such range as a director. Like, it's like, okay, I could totally see him directing Contact. Like, they'd be pretty easy for him compared to what he does most of the time. So strange. But the next as of this recording, the next Mad Max movie is going to be about Furiosa and starring Anya Taylor-Joy, an actress who I came to know through the Split and Glass films, who I've become a big fan of. I'm looking forward to seeing Last Night in Soho. I haven't seen that yet. As of this recording, it's just coming out. So I think that's a good choice. They were talking about doing Charlize Theron, right? To come back as a prequel, but George Miller didn't like the de-aging. He doesn't think we're there yet, de-aging wise. So he's like, we're just going to recast. So I don't know. I think Charlize Theron, she can still pull off being younger. I don't know how younger Furiosa is going to be in this movie. So that's a factor, I guess. But anyway, that's where we are as the current state of Mad Max. So.
Well, did you want to jump into the rest of the trivia?
Let's do it, Brandon.
Okay, let's do it.
So the idea for a fourth installment of the Mad Max movies came to George Miller in 1998. He was walking around L.A. Because he had been traveling between L.A. and Australia for his work. He thought of a story where instead of fighting for oil or material goods, people in the post-apocalypse were fighting for human beings. So they were set to shoot the film in 2001, but it was postponed due to the terror attacks of September 11th. The American dollar collapsed against the Australian dollar, and the budget got way too big, so they put it on hold because they couldn't justify the finances. So he moved on to Happy Feet. Again, the range of George. Oh, I can't do Mad Max 4. I'll do Happy Feet. Right. So he moved on to Happy Feet.
This is Academy Award winning Happy Feet.
That's right. This guy, man. Mel Gibson was originally going to return as Mad Max, but a combination of real-life controversies with Mel Gibson and also George Miller wanting to keep Mad Max at a certain age range, of a young warrior out there in the wasteland, led to them recasting him as the, quote, same contemporary warrior. That's the terminology that George Miller used when it came to recasting Mad Max. Now, during the hiatus of the project between 2003 and 2009, lots of other ideas were considered. George Miller thought about making it a 3D movie, an animated 3D movie, I should say, talking about 3D. No doubt off the strength of Robert Zemeckis' Beowulf. These guys are still connected on some level, I guess. So interesting. He was also developing a tie-in video game based on it, along with God of War. Video game designer Corey Barlog. So that would have been, I don't think is there a Mad Max video game?
Yeah,
there is. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. That makes sense. So I didn't know if there was like a really bad, like original Nintendo, like Beyond Thunderdome game or something. Like it seems like something they would do.
You got to kill people. You got to chain them to burning cars. And then you have to collect barrels of gasoline. While throwing bowling balls, like in Back to the Future, right?
That's right. So collecting pies or some nonsense, right? So finally, production was set to begin around 2011 in Australia, as you're talking about, Ryan, this is what we do. We make Mad Max movies, Mad Maxes from here. But as you're talking about, right, there was a lot of rainfall. The desert turned into a meadow of flowers. And they moved the production to Namibia, which I wasn't even – I had no idea where that was on the map before looking this up. But
that's interesting. So, yeah, Namibia's right in southern Africa. Like, South Africa's the bottom country, and then Namibia's, like, north of it. On the western coast of Africa. So it's like right north of South Africa, but on the western coast.
So this film was shot in sequence, which is something that has been done before in Mad Max. I guess due to the damage that the actors, characters, and cars take, it just makes more sense than have to reset everything. And when you're basically in one location, doesn't really matter about if you shoot in sequence or not. So I thought that was interesting. And there were a couple stipulations that George Miller made regarding the look of the film. He wanted the cinematography to be as colorful as possible to differentiate it from other post-apocalyptic movies, which have this bleak, desaturated tone, which movies that I like, right? But Terminator Salvation, Book of Eli, right, et cetera, et cetera. It's like this very brown, washed out. And he was like, let's not do that. Let's make it vibrant.
So if they're making a movie vibrant, then why the hell would they release a black and white version of this film?
It's true.
You got me there.
that's bonkers. Like, see, that's what I'm talking about. Like with Parasite, you know, the black and white version doesn't make any sense. And that, like, a black and white version of this wouldn't make any sense to me either. I love black and white movies, but just for these, it doesn't make any sense. It's bonkers.
The second thing, which I thought was an interesting concept, was the art direction would be as beautiful as possible, because George Miller reasoned people living in the post-apocalypse, they would try to find whatever scraps of beauty left over from the time before and incorporate it. So that, to me, that's an interesting concept. That explains, like, why they have this more flamboyant clothing throughout the movies and things like that. So there's, like, an in-universe reason for that beyond just being weird. So I thought that was an interesting mindset. Now, the editor of Fury Road is Margaret Sixel, and she's actually George Miller's wife. And George Miller had this to say to her about editing the film. He said, quote, "If a guy did it, it would look like every other action movie." So that's kind of the mindset that he wanted her to bring to the film. Hey, it paid off because she won an Academy Award for Best Editing.
Nice.
What an editing masterpiece this is, right? It was a challenge, too, because she said she had about 470 hours of raw footage from this film to watch, and it took about 3 months to go through it all.
Wow.
Night scenes were filmed in the day, deliberately overexposed and color manipulated. In a lot of those instances, the sky was digitally replaced or with more interesting looking skies, like the crow sequence and all that, the blue area and all that, which, you know, day for night is something that, you know, low budget films usually do because they can't afford, like, the lights to film at night. And then we got George Miller. He's gone totally full circle. He's gone, like, complete low budget. We have no money to, we have so much money, we're going to intentionally do something to be extra artistic. So I thought that was and there was a different look to it. Now knowing that was day for night, I see it now. So yeah. I thought that was pretty interesting.
Yeah, I could tell that watching it too. I'm like, yeah, this is definitely day for night.
Now, according to Tom Hardy, he had lunch with Mel Gibson to discuss him taking over the role. Gibson told him that he was fine with it and gave him his blessing. So passing the knee brace on to Tom Hardy, I guess, you know, Indiana Jones, the fedora, and Mad Max with the knee brace, you know, everybody has their signature. The jacket worn by Tom Hardy in the film is actually a replica of the one worn by Mel Gibson in the last two movies of the original trilogy. The original jacket was found in storage at the Kennedy Miller Productions, and they copied it. Also, wardrobe-wise, like I said, Mad Max is wearing a metal knee brace, like the one in The Road Warrior and Mad Max 2 and Beyond Thunderdome and all that. You know, we can put a pin in that and talk about where this fits in the continuity, if it's like a sequel or reboot. This is always a fun rabbit hole to go into. Tom Hardy suffered a broken nose during filming because when him and Charlize Theron were fighting, she accidentally elbowed him in the face, and she was wearing a green arm cast at the time for the scene when they're fighting, and she doesn't have her prosthetic arm on. They had to digitally erase it, hence the green cast, hence him getting hit in the face. Why was that? Well, you know, I'm not saying that it was intentional, but apparently there were there's a lot of drama on the set. George Miller and Charlize Theron did not get along with Tom Hardy at all during filming. They found him very difficult to work with. And he actually apologized at the premiere at the Cannes Film Festival to George Miller for being so difficult to work with. So,
Wow, that's crazy. That's I don't know. Like it's weird seeing a different actor in there. I think Tom Hardy did a good job, but I haven't heard any stories of him being difficult to work with before. You know,
there's I think as with any actor, there's always stories out there that sort of float around. But I think I you kind of get that energy from him in his press junket sometimes, and it's sort of just like a, you know, let's just get this sort of thing over and done with. I've got other things to do type of thing. But I mean, you know, it's hard to judge because you sort of don't know the situation, especially, you know, they're out in the God knows how hot desert, probably shooting 13, 14, 15 hour days and stuff like that. So
got this thing on his face all day. So yeah, maybe you should be used to that by now, right?
You know, yeah, exactly. Out the brain.
Is that like kind of some kind of like meta joke when she's like, you want that thing off your face? To Mad Max, I'm like, because you think about Bane, you think about he was in Dunkirk after this, wearing a mask. Like he's always got something on his face. It's such a cliche now, but in a brief word on that, like real world controversies aside, they could have just brought Mel Gibson back for this. I mean, like you didn't need a younger guy like to do all the things that he does. Like he just doesn't do Mad Max. I mean, people say that Furiosa is more the main character of this film, and I mean, that's pretty accurate. Like you could have brought Mel Gibson back for Mad Max if you had really wanted to for this film, mm-hmm. I think, and it would have been more like just a sequel, you know. But now we have this, like, well, it's a reboot. It's kind of not. I don't know. So that's where I land on it.
Yeah, I'm not sure where I thought this was originally. Like, I'd only seen it once in the theaters. So over the years, I'm thinking, well, is this a reboot or is this like a thing where it's like James Bond and Max is just a name or something like that? Like, that's kind of what I was thinking. But then I saw the credits when I'm watching it this time, and it says, no, it's Max Rockatansky is how he's billed in this, right? And I mean, like, I remember when this movie came out in theaters originally, right? Like, the biggest complaint that people had, like, it was almost universally praised, right? But there's always that subsection of fandom that complains when it doesn't, oh, you're ruining my childhood, right? Because this is more Mad Maxine than Mad Max, right? And, I mean, like, I never had a problem with that. I thought Charlize Theron was great, but it almost felt like it could be that, too, where it's just, it's Mad Max is just like a symbol for a person living in the apocalypse almost, you know, at that point. So, because we've made the joke that even in the second movie, he never says his name. Somebody else says his name in Mad Max 2, right? So, like, you know, anyways, that's all.
Yeah, and there's actually a fan theory that the Mad Max in this film was the feral kid from The Road Warrior. Right, because he doesn't speak very much and he grunts a lot. He also has a music box like the one that Max gave the feral kid. So I was like, what are you saying here, George Miller? Is this another Gyro Captain Bruce Spence situation? It's like, but apparently there is, as there always is in this day and age, right? There's some tie-in comic books that make it very clear, co-written by George Miller, by the way, that establishes that Tom Hardy's Mad Max is the same character as Mel Gibson's Mad Max. There's also a comic book series about how Morton Joe came to power. So this is where we live in this day and age in cinema. There's always a tie-in comic book to explain, expand, that kind of thing. So yeah, it's fine. Those things exist. I think as long as the stories are not dependent on them to stand on their own, that's fine, they expand. But I think a dangerous road, not for this franchise name, but a dangerous road for others is like, well, you have to read the book and the comic book and play the video game to understand everything. Kind of like The Matrix, Brandon, but we'll talk about that in our next franchise we cover. But anyway, speaking about Furiosa, Uma Thurman was considered for the part of Furiosa, no doubt off the strength of her performances in Kill Bill. I think she would have been great as well, a very solid choice. But I love Charlize Theron. She's one of my favorite actresses, and I think she was fantastic in this. And she actually shaved her head for the role. To that end, she had to wear a wig for her next film, In a Million Ways to Die in the West. So, but again, range is the name of the game, because when she's some ridiculous, stupid Seth MacFarlane comedy after this, with the brilliant Back to the Future Easter egg in it, by the way, which is spoiled about the trailers. Just want to throw that out there. Now, returning characters, actors here, right? Hugh Keyes-Byrne plays a Martin Joe. He played Toe Cutter in the first film, and this was actually his last film, because he was in his later years here, and he actually passed away a few years after this in 2020. So poor one out for Hugh Keyes-Byrne, the man who would have been Martian Manhunter,
Indeed.
In George Miller's Justice League, huh? How about that, Ryan?
Indeed. Heck of a costume. Heck of a costume.
Now, and he wasn't the only character, actor to appear in this film who was going to be in George Miller's Justice League. Megan Gale was going to be Wonder Woman. Once the project fell through, he specifically created a role for her in Fury Road. And her character was actually supposed to live at the end, but she actually got pregnant during the production and had to leave early. So he just decided, well, we'll just kill her off. So, but I was unfamiliar with Megan Gale, obviously, outside of the pictures I had seen as her in the Wonder Woman costume. And I'm like, yeah, she totally could have been Wonder Woman a few years before this. Yeah. She would have been great, I think. And I really like that Wonder Woman costume we've seen pictures of.
Yeah, it's great.
So is she the pregnant one of Morton Joe's girls?
No. She's actually, when they, that's bait, that scene, she is the bait in the cage.
Okay.
So the crossed belts worn by her, her character, were the same belts that Mad Max wore in Beyond Thunderdome. The brass belt buckle has been covered or replaced by the interesting, you know, again, just continuity of the wardrobe there. One of the most interesting elements of this film is the flame shooting guitar player.
Oh, I love that, man. That is just amazing.
What is this, right? But it's so, like, immediately iconic, and he's played by Australian artist musician Sean Hape, better known as Iota. And he said the guitar weighed 132 pounds and shot real gas-powered flames, which he controlled using the whammy bar. So, again, practical effects, right?
That whole sequence is so amazing. Like, it's just ridiculously over the top and perfect for this franchise. They're just all those speakers and that guitar instead of, like, and those drums, like that whole truck of drums, man, that's just, that's beautiful. It's just art. That's just art.
Now, when Mad Max awakes from his dream, right after they go through the blue sequence, the last image of the dream is footage from the first Mad Max of the eyes popping out of the face. The shot they used twice, actually, in that film. They liked it so much, they brought it back here. I think that was a fun Easter egg to bring back from the first film. So because that's a really fun shot, I think. So the last bit of the film where Max just kind of wanders off into the crowd, George Miller had this to say, quote, "Very early on, I had Max going up to the top of the Citadel with them, but Tom Hardy picked up that very early. Max would never go. He wasn't ready for that. We end on Furiosa and the others taking over all the resources, and it asked the question, are they going to do any better?" So it's an interesting point. I didn't think about that point per se, but I do think it's very in character for him to just, because really he's the man with no name. He wanders in, he wanders out. Yeah. Like that's much more in character for him to kind of just go. He's like, I'll make my own way. Right. That kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's a very fitting ending and setting him up for more adventures. And this is, you know, this is really how they should do. Honestly, this is how they should do Indiana Jones. You know, I mean, there's a lot of parallels to this franchise, Indiana Jones, where it's like, we had this great trilogy in the 80s and now we're going to bring it back like 20 years later. But of course, Indiana Jones kept Harrison and four, this did not, but it's like get one of the Chris's, I don't care which, Chris Pine, you know, Chris Hemsworth, Chris Pratt, put a fedora on one of them, they can be Indiana Jones, we can have more adventures of him fighting the Nazis in the 30s forever, right? And I don't know, I just think that's probably a better approach for something like that than casting a checks notes 80-year-old Harrison Ford play Indiana Jones in, I guess, the 1970s, right? So anyway, that's my thoughts on how those relate to each other.
At some point, they got to say goodbye to these people. Like, they can only do these roles for so long. Like, you know, Star Trek VI, Kirk was getting too old at that point, right? And everybody's like, how can we bring him back? How can we bring him back? And so, like, that's why I appreciate Generations and the fact that they killed him in Generations. But it's like, you can only do movies with these characters for so long, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Unless you recast with Chris Pine.
Unless you recast. That's right. Recast him. Or Jack Nicholson.
I actually would love that. I would love that.
And then finally, this is by far the highest-grossing Mad Max film. It made $375 million worldwide. But because it was so expensive to make, it ended up losing $40 million at the end of the day. Because, you know, marketing and all that, which is insane, right? Because incredible amount of financial return, incredible amount of critical praise, but it's still ended up losing $40 million, which probably was another hurdle of them making another one, which they are doing. So we will see. We'll be back to talk about Furiosa when that comes out. So
excellent, right on.
I think a big issue that they had was that they didn't really, there wasn't that much merchandising Like, I understand, like, it's well, actually, what's the rating? Is it PG?
It's actually rated R.
Yeah, they made a PG-13 version in the and R version to submit to the studio, and they were like, let's do rated R. So credit to them for sticking to their creative integrity, right? Instead of like, oh, let's cut down Terminator Salvation to PG-13. That'll appeal to the kids.
So. I want the alternate cut so bad.
This is a pretty light R, though, right? Like, it's, you know, like, there's a lot of over-the-top comic book violence that is in this.
Yeah, and even the language. Yeah, like, they pull a Battlestar Galactica and, like, make up words. Like, yeah, you're a slang sucker, or whatever it is. Like, you know what I mean?
Unless that's just general common discussion language in Australia. I don't know.
I mean, could be, man. We're, you know, it's pretty next level over here. It's pretty next level.
It's a pretty light R. Like, I when I was talking with you, I didn't actually end up watching this with Aubrey. We watched the second and the third one together, but she really liked those, but didn't really want to see more. When I told her that this was like basically nonstop action for an hour, like, she's like, well, that actually kind of sounds boring, right? Like, for the first hour of this, right? But I mean, so maybe in a couple of years I'll show it to her. But I misremembered how the women were portrayed as being like a lot kind of like grosser. So when I watched this again, like, seeing the milk mothers and whatnot, I'm like, well, that's a lot less than I remember it being in the theater. So, you know, I had concerns about that scene when I was going into it here, but no, I guess it was a lot tamer than I thought it was. Made more of an impact on me in the theater than it did in the home video market. So this movie here, it's amazing. Like right out of the, I'm just going to spoil it out of the gate. I love this movie. I think this is insane. I think this movie is amazing. And I, both times that I watched it for this, I was completely captivated, like, just from start to finish, because of the way that it's built and the way that the characters are acting. Like, it feels so true to the situation. Like, the tone of when Furiosa takes off at the beginning to go and get the gasoline from the other town, like, just the way that that world's been set up, and you can, in hindsight on repeat viewings, you're like, you can see that she's got a plan in her eyes, that she's got something going on. And when they turn, one of my favorite parts in the movie, it's so small, but it's when one of those guys comes up to her, climbs up to the front, and just starts talking to her. And it's like, okay, so we're not going to Gastown or whatever it is. I can't remember the name of it. He's like, we're not going to Gastown. And she doesn't answer. And he's just like, okay, change of plans. And he goes back down and relays it. And so, to me, I love the representation, because there's no questioning. He's got all his trust in this person, because Immortan Joe has all his trust in this person. You know, there's, in this world, this post-apocalyptic world, there's nothing about, like, you know, gender roles, women and men or whatnot in a position of power. Like, this guy's just got complete trust for Furiosa in this moment. And it's a small moment, but I just love that moment and how it was portrayed on screen. I just wanted to start there.
That stuck out to me too, but actually I feel sorry for all those guys, because they're so loyal and like, oh, what are we doing for you? So, oh, we gonna call for backup? Like, bro, you have no idea what's going on here, do you?
Yeah, so. I know.
No, I think for me, like, I just, you know, it's one of those things where, because it's even now, like, some people will still write this off as just like, oh, look, it's an incredible action movie, and they'll specifically say that, action film, action movie, blah blah blah. But like, I sort of like, I sit back and again watching. I watched it during the week in preparation. But like, I just look at the world building that's happening, just from like scene to scene, and like just random locations in the background, or you know, these offhanded comments or something that you just, every time you're just like, well, what does that mean? Like, what's like, where's that going to lead? But it's all so expansive, and like everything is just another layer, another layer, another layer. And exactly what you're talking about, Brandon, like, just conversation in the middle of, like, you know, action. And it's kind of just like, it's unbelievable. Like, it's there's a lot of praise being heaped around at the moment for things like Dune that's in cinemas, and world building in things like, you know, things that we've seen in the past, like Lord of the Rings and that kind of thing, Game of Thrones, et cetera. But like, I just think about, you know, how much story and world building happened inside of this movie that's essentially just like a chase scene, you know, at its most core, the most basic way to explain it is like, this is a chase scene. This whole movie is like a chase scene. And it's just, it's staggering to me. like the approach and the approach to be so fresh from a filmmaker who's been around for literally decades on the same franchise for decades.
Yeah.
You know, who bounces around from genre to genre and medium to medium, to even think about having this approach. And I think it's probably the best movie that's come out in the last like 10 years, to be honest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it's more than just an action film. Like, there's a lot of human moments in this movie, you know, and it's interesting because, like, I guess, unless I miss something, we don't really understand why he wants to harvest all this milk from these women, right? Like, they don't really talk about it, right? But then we've got this other thing that's going on where, you know, Furiosa wants to save these women because, like, they're completely in a relationship that lacks consent, and she wants to save them and rescue them and take them to where she was when she was a kid, right? Which is this mythical land of green where there was a whole bunch of women there. And when you get there, there's not much left of this community. It's been kind of destroyed over time. Like, the deserts have reclaimed it and whatnot. There's just a few women left. But, you know, you get this contrast to it where, like, while we have these strong women and these strong women leaders in this community, we've also got him completely dominating women and, you know, chauvinistic and abusing women and putting them in this situation, which ties into this safety zone that she's trying to get to, that's all women who are trying to isolate themselves from this post-apocalyptic period of, like, these nasty men and whatnot. So, like, it's really fascinating that they've got both of these layers going on in this story.
Oh yeah, I mean, like, he even calls them his property. I mean, it's all right there, right, for it to understand. Mm-hmm. And I think that's true, you know, and we've kind of talked about it a little bit, right? There is a criticism, a commentary that it's like, is it Mad Max or is it Mad Furiosa, right? And I think, you know what, I think they worked well together, right? Like, on their own, neither of them could have achieved their goals. And I think that should always be the goal, like working together, not like one sex over the other, especially the way they're portrayed, like in the fight, like, you know, he beats her. It's not just like she's coming in here and just wiping the floor with Mad Max and she's in charge now. It's not like that. And I think that's how some people act like it's portrayed. But I feel like this is a great balance of those gender dynamics, if you want to call them that, in this movie.
Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly. I think it's well balanced and well presented, and like it's as someone who, you know, I'm in a fairly privileged situation to have seen like a lot of what his plans were for his Justice League film and stuff like that, and it's sort of to see, you know, his approach to a character like Wonder Woman, and then see where he sort of like that sort of grew into something like Furiosa. And it just makes me sort of a bit sad that we will never get to see the dynamics that his take on Wonder Woman would have had with the greater DC universe. I know that's not really what we're talking about, but it's very interesting to me. Like,
yeah.
You know, to see his approach to those things is, you know, it's awe inspiring and it's really forward thinking, and I love it.
Well, to your point, Brandon, even the way you were describing it made me think of, like, well, Megan Gill's in charge of this group of women who were like kind of went off from society. I'm like, oh, this is the mascara of Paradise Island she was going to take them to. That's very interesting. So but George Miller's still getting those ideas in there, even when he couldn't make Justice League.
Yeah, I mean, like, but he's done this before, like with Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome, right? He's like, I want to make this movie about these Lost Boys and whatnot. And he ended up saying, well, why don't I just make this a Mad Max film? Which, Ryan, I wanted to ask you your theory on this here. I think that Walkabout is actually like a loose prequel to Thunderdome, right? Because, you know, like the guy kills himself in this post-apocalyptic and leaves his kids out in the middle of the wilderness. What do you think? And then they become the Lost Boys from Thunderdome. What do you think? Does this tie into Walkabout at all?
Oh, God, I've never even thought of
that. I'm just joking. I'm being silly here. So
I was like, oh, my God, this is blowing my mind. my opinion on Mad Max as a franchise is, like, I really like the idea of, like, I'm a big fan of anthologies and you know, just telling. So, like, for me, my in a perfect world, the same with like James Bond and stuff like that. It's these characters are almost like they're like mythic, basically, and these are just like almost like a retelling. Someone's retelling you the story of, like, this is who Mad Max was for me, you know, seeing Max disappear into the crowd at the end of Fury Road is almost, you know, it's this beautiful, like, poetic moment where it's just like, you know, my job here is done and I'll disappear, exactly like, you know, the Man with No Name, or I guess the Mandalorian or Hercules or Xena in, like, more sort of contemporary takes. But, you know, for me, that's how I approach it in my mind. So, like,
yeah,
if I would love if there was, like, a reference to, like, a Mad Max in Furiosa, and it is just a completely random actor that we don't know, you know, who this person is, and it's just like, okay, that's who Max was at that point in time. Mm-hmm. And let's take that approach.
I like that too. It's like each of these movies are framed by, like, okay, the kids' view of him in Beyond Thunderdome, the feral kid in the first sequel. The first film, I guess, it really is just him, you know. But then this film is like Furiosa and all of their interactions with him, and it's just going around a campfire talking about their encounters with the Road Warrior, who refers to himself as a Road Warrior. That was a cop, a Road Warrior. So yeah. I like that. And then you can, and again, the anthology thing, you get away with recasting, and just these are different interpretations of these events. So it could be never ending, as long as you got a good story to tell. Right, that's all you need.
I almost wish that he didn't refer to the character as Max Rokitansky in the credits, because, like, it could be that, like, just Max is just a label. And I would almost like to see it that way, because, you know, it could be that Furiosa is the next Mad Max, right? Like, and I would be fine if she was Max, like, if they just had named her Max or whatever. Like, I'm not the biggest James Bond fan, but I understand that there's a pretty loose continuity between the James Bond, and there's always this question of fandom of, is it supposed to be the same character, or is the 007 just a label and somebody comes in and replaces and takes over that label? So, like, from what I know, there's enough discontinuity between the characters that you could get a black James Bond, or you could get a woman James Bond, you know, to take over that role, because there's enough loose continuity that it doesn't have to be the same character every time. Yeah, and that could happen here too, right? Mad Max could just be like the post-apocalyptic world, you know, we're all Mad Maxes given the right situation, you know, kind of thing. So
no, I love that there's that area of conversation in fandom. Like, you can sit here and, like, well, you know, Roger Moore put the flowers at the grave of the wife George Lazenby, but then they say that Timothy Dalton was married, and say, anyway, like that's fun to talk about. Like, sitting here, like, could he be the feral kid? Like, these are fun conversations to have when you're really into these franchises. So I like how it's like kind of walks that line where, yeah, even though in the movie he's credited as so-and-so, like, you could still say, like, oh, well, this is one of the kids grown up, or this or that. And it, in the movie, like, in the universe, with all this, without you ignore the credits, you ignore all this extra material, you can bring your headcanon to it. What's the harm?
Yeah,
right. Sure. It could be the feral kid, and Mad Max made such an impression on that he's just like, my name's Max. Max Skywalker, right?
No, okay. All right. I take it all back. We need to stick to continuity. Oh, man. You know, but something else I really love about this film, though, is it, like all the Mad Max films, I think every time that George Miller makes another one, he refines, kind of repurposes, and ups the production value, all this stuff, right? Even, like, you know, Morton Joe was like this, like, turned up to 11 version of some of the other villains we've seen and all that. So the chases are even more extravagant. Now, credit to them, like, 80 to 90% of this film is practical effects. It's fantastic, right? Like, it's so amazing if you see, like, a behind-the-scenes photo of this. I'm like, oh, wow, all that was actually there. It's like they're fixing, like, the sky and not, like, adding cars. So anyway, just the production value is just, like, always gets upped, and we'll see how he tops it next time around, right? But I just think everything is more refined and polished and extravagant, and I really do appreciate that. Like, even, like, I mentioned Morton Joe, I'll mention him again. Like, his design, his costume design, and his preparation tells you so much about that character, right? So just those kind of attentions to world building, all the things we've been talking about, like I really appreciate that and respond well to it, and I think that's, it elevates what already is a great, not just action film, but a film, Ryan, to your point. So
my favorite practical effect in this film is those bars, that go back and forth from the one vehicle to another, like, what an amazing invention. They were talking about it in some of the behind the scenes stuff, that they got that from Cirque du Soleil. Like, that was something that was used in, like, Cirque du Soleil. They got Cirque du Soleil people to do some of those stunts. But I mean, like, that, you just see something like that built, and the world building that goes in your head is like, there are tons of car chases that go on in this universe all the time because they need to get from their vehicle to another vehicle in order to, like, take over that vehicle. Like, it just adds so much to it. But even still, like, them driving at speed on the top of these long bars with somebody at the bottom helping counterweight to, like, get them moving back and forth, that is nuts. That is absolutely nuts.
On that, like, stunts and stuff in particular, like, I said, you know, the Australia as a country is huge, but our film industry is generally pretty small. The stunt coordinator on Mad Max Fury Road was a bloke named Keir Beck, who I've worked with plenty of times. Even now, like, all these years, and he's huge. Like, Keir was Keanu's stunt double on The Matrix, going back, you know, way back to when they shot those in Sydney, and he's built, like, a fairly big career off the back of, you know, getting to do those films. But, like, people like Mick Ruffin, who's a rigger who worked on Fury Road. Like, he's another friend of mine who's worked on stacks of stuff, most recently things like the Suicide Squad and other big things overseas. And they all talk about, like, Fury Road is, like, the gig. Like, that was like the transcendent moment for everyone. A really good friend of mine, Jason Boland, was the stills photographer on Fury Road, and he's done the last few James Bond films and stuff as well, and pretty much everyone is in agreement that, like, that was the transcendent moment. That was, like, they're on set for Fury Road, you know, it's the craziest stuff they've ever seen just from a rigging standpoint, and you know, that was, like, it, we made it. Like, this is the creme de la creme, the top of the top. Like, it doesn't get bigger than this. We're out in the middle of the desert with, like, $250 million, we're about to, like, blow up all these cars with, like, you know, some of the craziest things you've ever seen. And yeah, even now, yeah, they look back on it with, you know, it was just an incredible experience. You know, obviously potential issues with Tom Hardy aside, but, you know, it sounds as though it was awe inspiring. I'm very jealous.
So we've mentioned a couple of times now in this discussion, we've talked about the continuity and whatnot. So, Ryan, where do you think this fits in the continuity of the franchise?
Oh, I don't know. It's too tough. And that's why I just, like, for me, I'm just going to go anthology. I'm just going to say it's just, like, a random side sequel, Superman Returns-esque, kind of connected, kind of not connected, carry a bit of this and a bit of that, but not tie itself down too much. Because the thing is, too, like, I think, like, how much reliance can you put on, especially modern audiences these days that just, like, cruise through content like it's nothing, to have any sort of, like, connection to movies from, you know, a few decades ago, even back then, you know, even 5 or 6 years ago. I think the references and stuff that are there from an ambiguous standpoint for people like us to be able to sit down and converse about. But for me, I look at it as basically like a soft reboot,
okay,
new universe type approach. You know, this is what I wanted to do and what I would have done originally, but ramped to, like, 200%.
Yeah.
Basically, like, that's my thoughts on it anyway.
Zach, what do you think?
No, I feel the same way. This is a vague sequel. Right, in the vein of Superman Returns, right? It's if you want to, like, again, if in your head canon, if you want to make it fit, you could, right? It's like, it's in between the first and second movie, or second and third movie, right? I mean, there's the freaking, what, 15-year gap between Mad Max 2 and Beyond Thunderdome, so lots of adventures you could have there. But the car, yeah, is a issue if you want to try, unless he just found another interceptor, which is very possible, right? But, like, it gets destroyed here and then redone, and then he could drive off it again at the end. So there are little things here, like you said, Ryan, for us to kind of, like, as fans to kind of, like, oh man, you just see that he had the same weapon as this and that and the knee brace and all that, and that's fun. But, you know, I think just it's just another anthology chapter in the legend of the Road Warrior, and hopefully we'll get some more in the future. I mean, for who knows, that's how you keep these franchises going. Right, yeah. Instead of, like, let's bring back 80-year-old Harrison Ford to fight communism in the 70s, I guess. I don't know what he's gonna do. I keep thinking about Indiana Jones. I just think this is the better. Well, the thing that works with Mad Max is it's not set in a particular like 1936 or something like Indiana Jones, right? It's the post a few years from now, whenever now is, right? That is what Mad Max is. And you can get away with that kind of storytelling much better in that post-apocalyptic future where everything is just kind of the same, but still this is still uniquely Mad Max, right? It's still like, oh, these eccentric outfits and the car chases and even though it is a soft reboot, it is still distinctly that franchise, and you wouldn't see this kind of thing in another franchise. And a lot of that is what George Miller brings to it himself. So that's where I stand.
Yeah, I'd probably put it in that soft reboot category as well. I mean, like, if I had to throw it somewhere, it'd probably be between 2 and 3, right? But I mean, like, yeah, like you said, the car is definitely an issue because it gets destroyed in Road Warrior, right? So it gets destroyed in Mad Max 2. But I mean, like, that's pretty minor.
It's like the Enterprise in Star Trek 3 gets blown up, so we know that there won't be any more Enterprises. It's just, these are the rules. That's right, yeah. So yeah.
That's
so.
Rules, yeah. I guess Scotty could have refitted that Interceptor, right?
So. That's it. So, last thing I'll say is, you know what? A character I didn't think I was going to care for was Nicholas Holt as one of the War Boys. I was like, what? Who is this guy? Right? He's going to be a bit. I'm like, he has quite a character arc in this, doesn't he?
That's the one that like falls in love with the woman.
Yeah.
One of the women kind of like takes pity on him and brings like, oh, look, he can drive. And I just thought like, that shows you like it's a because the guy's a complete zealot for Morton Joe, where he's like, oh my god, you looked at me. And I think one of my favorite moments of the movie is like Morton Joe's like, come here, son, I'm gonna give you this gun and I will escort you to Valhalla myself. And like, okay, here it comes, and the music swells, and then like he jumps, you know, he jumps on the truck, and then he just immediately falls off and loses the gun. Just mediocre. And it's just like, it sets you up for this, and then it just completely undercuts it. And I thought that was a great little moment there. And but yeah, he has a great story of, you know, redemption and turning it around and showing you that even these, you know, brainwashed war boys can, like, if you take him out of that environment and you show him some love and compassion and how the world really is, they can turn it around too. So I thought that was because you talk about so many other things going on in this film. I was like, you know what? I like that subplot. That's really solid stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do too. I think that's really great. Because, yeah, they don't know what's going on. Like, they're just, this is the environment that they were bred in, that they were raised in, right? I mean, like, Zach, which baseball team would you be cheering for if you grew up in New York, right? You know, like you're in your little community and you've been brainwashed to love who you love, right?
So I've been brainwashed to love who I love. Thank you, Brandon. Yes, that's correct. So
I don't even know baseball, so I don't even know which team you like.
Talking to two non-Americans here about baseball. What do you guys know? So
yeah, no, I think again that just comes back to like what I was talking about before with just world building. Like it's you know, there's so many characters that you can sort of just like pluck out of this film and like concentrate specifically just on like a scene or two. And there's so much character work that's gone on there. And that's obviously not by accident. Like that's conversations that George has had with these actors and you know, that's maybe not reflective in the script, but you know, it's definitely something that they've worked it out on set and stuff like that. So it's amazing. This is what I mean. Like, there's so many layers to it. Like, it's all character work, but think about what it's also adding to that, like, grander universe at large. You know, just again, from just, you know, a small subplot on this gigantic film. And it's unbelievable. If he was working more consistently, George Miller would absolutely always be in my top 5 working directors in the world. Always.
Mm-hmm. He's kind of like a James Cameron in a way where he's like, yeah, I've made like a handful of films, but they're all really, really good. So yeah. Good for you, man. And I think, yeah, even the world building of like when, you know, when he turns on the water and off the water and he's like, do not become addicted to water. You will resent his absence. And you can see the indoctrination and the desperation. Like there's a whole like what is going on in this status quo? Right. And it's just, it's crazy how you even get there. And it's, but man, I gotta say, man, like here we are with Mad Max. This is my final thoughts. It's like, what a franchise, right? What a franchise so far, because like, there's truly not a bad one of the lot. And how often do you get to say that? Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd agree. Absolutely. Right on.
Well, guys, I got a question for you.
Oh, do you?
I do. How many car crashes do you think happened in this movie?
Okay, I kept track, and I got 822.
I'm gonna say What constitutes a car crash? Is that an explosion? Is that a
anytime a driver loses control of the vehicle and it goes off its intended path?
Is this including motorcycles?
Yes, it is including motorcycles. Yes.
Okay. So. I'm gonna land in like the high like 190s.
Wow. Okay.
It's probably closer to 50 or something.
This is an approximate number, right? I don't have a scene by scene breakdown for everything, but I came up with 39.
I need a more accurate number than that, Zach. You're gonna have to go back and watch it again.
You guys were close.
Pretty close. Yeah, we're in the ballpark.
Most of which happened during the Furiosa escape, and then also the initial pursuit after that. After that, there's just a couple of things here or there, but 39 so far by my calculation, which brings us to a franchise total of 77. Car crashes for the Mad Max franchise. Over half of them in this film, no surprise, right? With that budget,
we'll have to get the Guinness World Records on the line and get them to check. And see
we need some fact checkers for this. I want some double confirmation for sure.
Practical car accidents.
None of this CGI. I want physical vehicles. So,
is this the movie with the most practical car crashes in it? Guinness, tell us, Guinness.
very well may be. So,
excellent. Right on. Awesome. Well, I've got a question for you guys here.
Oh.
Ryan, out of five, how mad does this movie make you?
Mad in love. 5 out of 5.
5 out of 5.
Larry, that's a good one. Mad in love. Well said.
You're insane. You're just that mad, you're insane. Zach, how about you?
Definitely 5 out of 5. Yeah. And we've been here singing its praises for an hour now. And I mean, of course, you could probably find some nitpicks here and there, but like this is just a fantastic. This is why people go to the movies for movies like this. So 5 out of 5 levels of madness for me.
Yeah, excellent. I think I'd give this a 2. No, I'm just kidding.
I mean, it's no Children of the Corn 4. Okay. Like, you know what? I love Star Trek 4, right? But this has to be like the best fourth entry of any franchise, right?
I'm still waiting for Godfather 4, though, right? So
Andy Garcia just waiting for that phone call.
Yes. This is a 5. This is absolutely a 5. You know, the first time I saw it in theaters, I did give it a 4. And I'm like, I don't know. I need some time to, like, kind of process this and whatnot. So when I came out of the theaters, I'm like, I think this is a 4. And that impression of, like, I don't know why I had this impression of this, of the milk mother scene just being way more gross than it was. I don't know what it was, but something about that scene really bothered me in the theaters. And it didn't quite bother me as much as it did after the fact. I don't know why. But I think that was part of the major reason. But yeah, definitely on my first rewatch of this film and my second rewatch of this film, definitely a 5. I love this movie. I think it's fantastic. Make more movies like this. Make more movies like this.
Well, last question for y'all. Ryan, I'll ask you first. Is this franchise fatigued? Or do you want to see more?
No, not at all. Yes, definitely want to see more. No fatigue whatsoever from me.
Brandon?
Yeah, me too. I can't wait for more. We'll discuss in our recap episode next, like, where I think it should go and what should be going on and what I thought after I left the theaters. But no, definitely not. This is a high point in the franchise, and, you know, it can only go up from here, right?
It is not fatigue for me either. I am very interested to keep watching Mad Max and Tom Hardy's quirky performance. I like Tom Hardy as an actor. He just is a very quirky guy, you know? And it's just every... It's like, I don't know. Like, it's bizarre. But I enjoy it for what it is. Like, he's just so over his head and all the time. And I don't know. Like, there's something about that that's compelling as well. So I am 100% on board for more of him, more of Furiosa being Charlize Theron or otherwise. So I'm looking forward to more adventures in the wasteland. So bring us into the wasteland, George Miller. That's what I say.
You know, if they want to up the stunts for the next film, I don't know if they don't. Maybe they could even replace him with Tom Cruise, and they could just up the stunts, right?
Yeah, have him hold on to an airplane. Is it?
They could bring Bruce Dern back,
Bruce
or whatever
Spence,
his name.
Yeah,
Bruce General Spence. Captain. Yeah,
bring him back as a third character. Yeah.
Yeah. And having Bruce Dern in this film would
be a different
thing
as well. Right,
yeah.
Yeah.
As the big bad. Yeah, no doubt. Yeah. Bruce Dern is the guy in charge of the next town. That's fantastic. Laura Dern, if we're friends with Furiosa, Charlize Theron. It writes itself, really. So, yeah.
Excellent. Right on. Ryan, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate having you join us and having your perspective on this film that we all love here. So it's definitely a joy having you here. Why don't you tell listeners where they can find you online? And is there anything else you're working on that you can talk about right now? I know that NDAs and whatnot, maybe you can't talk about too much, but you know.
Well, firstly, thank you for having me. This has been very, very, very fun. It's not often that you sort of get the opportunity to talk about big films that are sort of like, you know, the reason that your country is sort of on the map from a filmmaking standpoint outside of Crocodile Dundee. thanks for that. It's been good fun. But no, if people are interested in my sort of general day to day musings, I'm on Twitter at It's Ryan Unicum, and I'm on Instagram at It's Ryan Unicum as well. Or you can find me, I've got a verified Facebook page that they can just find under Ryan Unicum as well. In regards to work, yes, there's a few things happening at the moment. There's a few things also that are held up thanks to some big companies buying out other big companies. So there's some legal legwork that needs to happen there before some cool stuff gets seen. But we'll get there.
I know what you're talking about. I'm looking forward to some of that cool stuff. So
yeah, very cool stuff.
Yeah.
You have to tell me off mic there.
Yeah.
That was excellent. Zach, where can people find you when you're not trying to be a hero and save the women that are being held against their will?
Well, first of all, Brandon, we don't need another hero. But second of all, you can find me on Twitter at MoronZach. That's MoronZach. I'm also the host on my own podcast, Always Hold On to Smallville, where we talk about each and every episode of That Young Superman Show and all kinds of Superman related things. Been talking a lot about Zack Snyder's Justice League over there this year, so go check that out. I'm also the co-host of Sasquatch, a Bigfoot multimedia podcast here at UFP. So check us out there as well.
Excellent. Right on. And as for me, you can find me here on the network with another show called Infinite Diversity, which is all about new Star Trek. And as of the recording of this, I guess it's tomorrow that we're going to be recording it. I guess this episode's coming out in just a couple days, but we're looking forward to discussing our first episode on Star Trek Prodigy, which I loved. I thought it was absolutely fantastic. So I'm looking forward to covering that show. Aubrey's going to guest on the podcast when we cover it. So I'm looking forward to that. That's going to be fun. So I got that. And then I got Good Evening and Alfred Hitchcock podcast over on the Fandom Podcast Network, as well as in our own independent feed. And this Friday, you can get our great episode on Vertigo. So be sure to check that out. That's a wonderful film that was the first time I actually revisited. I hadn't seen it in like 20 years. And so this was just my second watch. So it blew me away as it was fresh. So, and then, still taking my social media break, still not online. So, I'm around, but, not really online. So, well, that's all we got for you now. So that's all we got for you here. Next time we're going to be covering The Matrix. After we do our Mad Max recap, we'll be covering The Matrix, and we have special guest Marcelo J. Pico of the Talk Film Society joining us for the first one. But we'd like to thank, Ken Tripp and Tony Robinson for being executive producers of the network. Thank you so much to Tony Robinson for creating our wonderful show art. Thank you much to Zach Tripp for creating our wonderful theme music. Thank you so much to the associate producers of our show, David Willett and Casey Pettit. Thank you so much for supporting the network and this show in particular. We greatly appreciate it. I think that's it. I think that's our normal coverage. Twitter at Franchise Fatigue, Twitter at UFP Earth, email FranchiseFatigue@UFP.earth and contact@UFP.earth. Those are the places you can find us here. So until next time, when we revisit The Matrix, Zach, which one of these pills did you want to have, blue or red?
Shh! Witness! Witness me!
This has been a production of MTMR Media Works.